T.J. Lydon says he was a street-fighting, racist skinhead when he joined the Marine Corps back in the 80s. What's more, he says the military made him a better racist.
If my drill instructor would have said, jump in front of that bullet, you won't die, I would have jumped in front of a bullet. I realized how somebody in boot camp can take you from just an average Joe citizen and make you, you could do anything. How you tear down and rebuild. And I said, you can use that on anybody.
And he did. When TJ left the Marines, he became a regional recruiter for the Hammerskin Nation. That is, until he started having his own second thoughts about hating people for a living. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The whole question of who gets to serve in the military is back in the news. A House committee report in Washington says that the Army and the Marines recruited significantly more felons last year than the year before. 511 felons got waivers to join the Army. The Marines took in 350 people with records. Here's the way the news was reported on one NPR program.
The bulk of the crimes involved were burglaries, thefts, and drug offenses, but there were more serious crimes, too. Some recruits had convictions for sex crimes, manslaughter, or vehicular homicide. Several dozen had aggravated assault or robbery convictions, including incidents involving weapons. And two were convicted for terrorist threats, including bomb threats.
T.J. Lydon knows exactly what it's like for a kid with a troubled past to find his way into the military. He did that himself. And he brought all his racist views with him.
I was getting in a lot of trouble from 18 to 21, and at 21 I decided I had to get out of Dodge because the cops were on me, and I was going to end up going to state prison because they told me, we're going to get you one of these days, and we're going to get you good.
Because they knew you. They had you marked?
They had me marked.
You've been arrested a couple of times?
By that time, probably half a dozen, almost somewhere between half a dozen times.
So if you were caught with a weapon or on some kind of serious offense, you were going to jail for a while, right?
Yeah, I was already caught once with carrying a loaded concealed weapon, a handgun, and I knew if I had got another charge, it was a one-year minimum state prison.
So what did you do?
I joined the Marine Corps.
Easy to get in?
Easy. Just walked down to the recruiter, walked up, walked in, said, I want to be a Marine. I want to go to boot camp. He said, okay, sign on the dotted line. Let's take you down. Took me through MEPS, which was the medical evaluation. Yep. They checked me out, and I was in the Marine Corps 2 months later.
TJ, you're sitting here with a short sleeve shirt on, and I can see the tattoos on your forearm. Did the Marine recruiter, see those tattoos?
I didn't have any tattoos below the elbow at that time, but across my back, I had U.S. and then I had skins on one, I also had on my leg. I had a swastika.
No, so for the physical, they would have seen those tattoos.
They noticed, yeah.
Did they say anything about them?
No.
What did they think? That, you know, sort of some kid, youthful indiscretion, put some tattoos on, they don't mean anything? Or did they know better?
At that time, the Marine Corps didn't care.
Take me back. Where are we now? In the late 80s?
We're in 1988, and the military's policy at that time was that you could belong to any racially motivated hate group and serve in the United States Armed Forces as long as you were considered a passive member.
That was policy.
That was policy.
And at the time, TJ, where were you on this sort of white supremacist track? Were you just some, skinhead gang member, or were you—
I was a skinhead thug and doing all that stuff that, you know, I was just trying to show everybody that I was tougher than everybody else on the street. It used to be that if I got in a fight and I lost, I went home and got a bat, came back and made sure that you lost. I was that kind of person. I didn't want to lose a fight, even if I had to come back and attack you 10 times.
T.J. Lydon says that long before he thought about joining the military, he'd already decided that he liked the image and the life of a skinhead.
I was going to a lot of punk rock concerts, and I noticed that these skinhead guys were the guys that were controlling everything. Well, these are the baddest of the bad.
Right.
So I started venting my frustration, my anger, a lot of my violence from what was going on at home. I couldn't vent on my parents, so I was venting on the kids. These guys noticed my violence, started asking me to hang out with them. I'm 14. These guys are 19, 20, 21. Come on over here. And I was like, I had big brothers for the first time, so to speak.
Yeah, why? Who would say no under circumstances like that, right?
Yeah.
And so what they saw in you was just a little hard-ass, just somebody who would stand up to anybody or someone who wanted to fight. Is that why they were drawn to you?
I think they were drawn to me because of my violence. And that's exactly what they were. And that's what they wanted. They were a gang. They were the gang inside the punk rock movement, the skinheads were. And originally, it wasn't like all about white supremacy, but it developed into it very, very quickly. And I just went straight with them.
Now, did you have to change what you wore, change how you looked, all that?
I changed really a lot about it, what I wore. Before that, I wore jeans that were all holy. I had a mohawk. And then all of a sudden, I'm wearing buttoned-up shirts, pants that fit me.
The mohawk's gone.
And the mohawk's gone. I'm wearing boots. My parents thought, hey, besides for the boots and the no hair, he looks normal.
Huh.
They thought, hey, those kids you're hanging out with, they're not bad. So they thought, he's growing up. And I always tell parents, if your son all of a sudden starts taking a shower and he's starting to look clean and he's dressing a little bit nicer, you know, it's either a girl or he's joining the Nazis.
TJ, just step me through 15, 16, 17, 18. You were a full-time neo-Nazi kid at that point, or it was like a hobby? What did it mean to you?
By 15, I was going to school to pull more kids to come hang out with me, to go do some crazy things.
You were a recruiter?
Well, back then I was starting to recruit mostly for what I was at that time. I was a soldier. We were drinking during school time. Usually by the end of the night, we were so lit up, we were looking for fights and partying, you know, attacking people. 18, I got stabbed.
In a fight, in a bar?
You know, I was actually working. I was actually a manager of a fast food restaurant, and I was working, and I went out of the parking lot, and some Hispanic guys who we had been fighting with asked me to come over. And I didn't know that one of their guys was savagely beaten that night by some of my friends. So I walked up to the car, and as I leaned up towards the window, one of the guys in the back seat took a box cutter knife and tried to slash my throat. And I put my hand up, and it cut my hand completely. I ended up with 18 stitches. Luckily, I didn't lose a tendon or something, but then there were shootings and things like that.
The kind of life that you're describing is a lot like gang life as we know it today, as it's described today. Is that a reasonable comparison?
You're just a gang member who has white skin and a shaved head. There's no difference.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. T.J. Lydon was an ex-felon, a white supremacist, a neo-Nazi, who decided to join the Marines as a way of staying out of trouble. He was not expecting what happened to him once he put on a uniform.
The military made me a better racist. They taught me organizational skills, leadership ability, recruitment techniques. When I graduated boot camp, if my drill instructor would have said, jump in front of that bullet, you won't die, I would have jumped in front of a bullet. That's how much I believed.
So the Marines made you a better soldier, a better disciplinarian. Why does that equate to making you a better racist?
Because I realized when I left boot camp and I got back and I got into the fleet, I realized how somebody in boot camp can take you from just an average Joe citizen and make you could do anything. I realized their technique of how you tear down and rebuild. And I said, you can use that on anybody.
But as a Marine, were you still then well connected with your former skinhead?
When I was in the Marine Corps, I contacted them probably once a week. I sent them manuals from the military. Would go to the PX and buy fatigues and send them in the mail. The BDUs, military, you know, uniforms. I'd send it to them.
And was that because they thought this was cool and you were cool, or were they also starting to say, hey, we have something to learn from the military, we want to look more closely at it?
A lot of them that couldn't get into the military because of different reasons, because they had felons, violent felonies and stuff. A lot of them were trying to go into what they was called the underground, learning military tactics, learning military skills for the coming race war. And the late 80s is when a lot of the skinheads who were starting to get in trouble, who weren't going to jail, joined the military. And they were learning the combat skills. And a lot of the white supremacy main groups started seeing, hey, this is great. We could send these guys in to get military training. They come back, they train the guys that can't get in. So it became a tactic where they kept sending guys in. I was stationed in Hawaii, of all places, and there was at least a dozen guys on that base that we used to hang out with that were all white supremacists.
T.J. Lydon tells one story of how the Marines he served with did not mix well.
A bunch of the good old boys from the South were out at the beer garden, and across the way from him, there was a group of about 50 to 60 blacks who were flying the Marcus Garvey flag.
Marines. Yeah.
So I said, hey, they're flying the separatist flag. You know, and I told one of my buddies, I said, why don't you guys get, you know, good old Dixie out there, put it on there. And they went out and they put the rebel flag out there, the Confederate battle flag. And I went in my wall locker. I took my swastika flag out, walked down to the beer garden and put it on there.
This is a group of Marines we're talking about.
United States Marines. On one side, you've got the black separatist flag, and on the other side, you've got the Confederate battle flag and the swastika flag.
Now, are you guys going to fight each other? Or is this just sort of chest bumping? I mean, you're all Marines,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's chest playing. It's like, we know what you have, now you know who we are. And the MPs drive by.
Yeah, I was going to say, where are they?
They see it. They pull in like five or six cars. Sergeant gets out, comes up, tries to grab my flag, and I said, you grab that flag, that's personal property. I can have your rank. He said, I want you to take this down. I said, I'll take this flag down, we'll take down the Confederate battle flag, but you walk over there and you tell the blacks to take down that Marcus Garvey black separatist flag. And the white sergeant looked over there, and there's about 100 black guys, and he's like, I don't know if I want to do that. I said, but you'll take ours down, but you won't take theirs down. Which actually helped me. Because I told the guy, see, it's anti-white. As long as it's black, it's okay. But if it's white, they're against us. Help me start more recruiting. Eventually, a couple of the black military police officers walked over, and they said, okay, they're going to take it down when you take yours down. So we took ours down. They took theirs down. Everything was okay.
And when you think back to that, TJ, was it just young men showing off on a Saturday afternoon? Or did it tell you more about what was going on inside the military at that
time? Well, it told me a lot. It told me that the military has no policy at all about how to educate people on racial differences, cultural differences. I mean, this is a vast country.
TJ Lydon says he had very little trouble with his activity as a neo-Nazi during the time he was in the Marines. This was back in the late 80s and the 90s. The military says it's been cleaning up its ranks, but the Southern Poverty Law Center reported on a resurgence of skinheads in uniform just a couple of years ago, and they say nothing much has changed. TJ Lydon himself was eventually bounced from the Marines, and he eventually came to believe that an all-white, all-Christian America might not be so supreme after all. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. For the past few years, we've been hearing how hard it's been for military recruiters to fill annual quotas. Questions about the war in Iraq make it a lot harder to convince young men and women to sign up. A report this week says that the Army and Marines gave more waivers and recruited significantly more felons in 2007 than in 2006. Lieutenant General James Thurman is the Army Deputy Chief of Staff.
We are growing the Army fast. There are some waivers. We know that. It hadn't alarmed us yet, but the thing of it is, you got to give people opportunity to serve.
One investigator with the Department of Defense says that recruiters are also knowingly allowing neo-Nazis and white supremacists to join. TJ Lydon was once one of those men.
I was in the Marine Corps for 3 years.
And did you leave of your own volition? Did they kick you out?
I was discharged in what was called an other than honorable discharge. I was still drinking and fighting a lot, but I also got to a point where I knew if I kept drinking and fighting, I would get put into what was known as a treatment program. I went to the program and flunked, came back. My base commander looked at me and said, well, I'm going to discharge you. I said, great. I'm cool.
Don't you think it's possible, TJ, that they also knew you were a recruiting leader in the white supremacist movement and they also wanted you out for that reason as well?
They won't say that, but I know that's what it was. But I wanted out as bad as they wanted me out.
TJ Lydon says that soon after his discharge, he wound up putting his military training to work with the white supremacists.
Well, I ended up getting married to a girl who I've been riding to. She was a Hammerskin at that time, and I was a Hammerskin at that time.
Hammerskin, what's that?
Hammerskin Nation is the largest neo-Nazi skinhead gang in the world. It also calls itself an organization, but it's basically a very organized gang. 15 days after we met, we were married. 4 months later, she's pregnant with my first son. Started contacting some of the leaders. They had heard about me from my military stuff that I've been giving to people and some of the training I've been doing. And then I slowly become a regional recruiter. And everybody started knowing me.
Including the cops as well?
Including the cops again.
So you're on your way up within this organization.
Yeah.
What changed? What turned it for you? Because you're not in it anymore.
My son, one morning, we were watching a show on Nickelodeon called Gullah Gullah Island. Me and my 11-month-old, my 3-year-old walks over the TV set when he wakes up, turns it off, turns to me and says, "Daddy, we don't watch shows of niggers in the house."
This is your 3-year-old.
3-year-old.
And at the time,
I was
senior guy in the white supremacist movement. Did you pat him on the head and say,
I gave him a hug. You know, I was like, oh, man.
You love that N-word coming out of a 3-year-old's mouth, right?
Way to go. I walked back over to the couch, sat on the couch, kicked my feet up on the coffee table, and I'm watching him sitting there playing with his brother. And I'm thinking about, who's he going to be? And I kept trying to think of anything other than me, my cousins, and my friends.
Isn't that what you want? You don't want him to grow up like you at that point?
I wanted him to be successful, something other than who I was. And it really made me look at who I was. And all I really was a glorified thug. I really wasn't anything else.
You say that now. You look back at that part of you now. But did you actually think of yourself even then as a kind of a glorified thug?
I thought of myself as, who am I? And really, where am I going to end up? I mean, I still got the cops on me. I know that the feds probably watch me from time to time. And I'm thinking, anytime some of the stuff I'm getting involved with, it could backfire and I could go away for a very long, long time in prison.
But TJ, you're so far down the track, so well known for being the skinhead. How do you put this motor in reverse?
It wasn't easy. I mean, I had a very hard time. I mean, I was reading books. I was trying to say, well, this question, what I was believing, this question, some of the things I was thinking, and it was hard. There were some times I was saying, well, this is right. This is why I'm supposed to be this way. And so the days I was like, well, this is wrong. And I was bouncing back and forth, and I think one of the next things that really got me, which triggered a thing in my head, I was up at Aryan Nations when they still had the compound in Idaho. And it's about 25 of us in the room. Pastor Butler's holding a little meeting.
Fairly senior group of people.
Yeah. I raised my hand and said, Pastor Butler, if we wake up tomorrow and everybody on this planet who's not white and Aryan is dead, we're the victors of this race war. What are we going to do next? And this guy sitting next to me slapped me on the leg and said, hey, TJ, will you sit your stupid, you know, butt down? Because we're going to start with hair color next.
You mean going after people who didn't have the right hair color? People who weren't blonde.
It was just a joke.
Yeah, okay.
And I sat down, but I thought, where would we go?
What's the whole point?
And I thought, okay, I'm going to ask this one more time. I asked it at a different party, and one guy said, oh, we'll just kill the non-racist Christians. It really didn't matter. The hate is just going to be redirected in a different direction towards, quote-unquote, your own people.
So are you saying that your own views as a neo-Nazi, as a white supremacist, actually changed, or you just realized that it wasn't going to lead you anywhere?
It was stupid. The problem was I had been thinking this way for 15 years. So it wasn't just like, oh, I can turn the light bulb off. And I still, to this day, am not racist free. I still have a problem with racism that comes into my head. I wish I could sit here and say, oh, I'm perfectly racist free. But I had 15 years of indoctrination, 15 years of brainwashing. You know, how come I can't destroy that thing inside me, that evil part of me, that why does it keep coming out? It wasn't really until my mom suggested that I go to this place called the Simon Wiesenthal Center and his Museum of Tolerance one morning at breakfast, and I thought she was smoking crack. I was like, you're not serious, Mom. Do you know that's a Holocaust museum? That's a Jewish human rights center named after a great Nazi hunter. Do you know that? She goes, yeah, you have to go there. I'm like, no way.
Did she figure this was the way to turn you around?
I guess she thought it was a way for me to repent or, you know, something. So I was like, no, you know, you're crazy. She kept after me, said, fine, I'll call when I get the number. She pulled the number right out of her pocket. Said, here's the number, call him. The guy's name is Rick Eaton. Contacted Rick Eaton, told him about all the Nazi material I had in my garage. He said, if you want it, come get it. If not, I'm just going to toss it in the trash. He asked me to bring it in. I brought him a box from my front seat. He said, thank you. I said, sir, that's a box from my front seat. I have a truck outside. I need help unloading.
Five photo albums full. You just dump it off and say, it's yours. I'm out of here.
I give it to them. And he goes, can you stick around for a while? And I said, yeah, I can stick around for a while. That ended up being an 8-hour day.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. That one day at the Wiesenthal Center started a bigger change for T.J. Leiden than he might ever have imagined. The former white supremacist neo-Nazi continued to work there, though he had some learning to do.
I didn't find out Rick was like Jewish for like 6 months.
You know, pretty good odds working at the Holocaust Center.
Well, I mean, he's not wearing a kippah or yarmulke or anything, yeah. And he's like, you know, ordering stuff, you know.
Do you think it would have made a difference? Had you known at the time?
It may have made me a little more leery because of all the stuff that was still going in on me. You got to remember, I'm freshly out. There's a lot of stuff. I'm becoming paranoid now. I'm out. I'm worried about everybody now. So it ended up being almost 2.5 weeks off and on that I was talking to them.
The cops, Rick, other people at the center.
Yeah, and I left. I figured I did my great deed for society, you know. They haven't contacted me.
I have repented, yeah.
Yeah. I told the Jewish Human Rights Center what's going on, told the FBI, local cops, state police what's going down with these guys. They can pass the information on to other states that I know, and I'm going to fade into the woodwork. I'm going to disappear. And about 10 days later, I get a really weird phone call. I get a phone call from Rabbi Abraham Cooper. He's the associate dean of the Wiesenthal Center. Then I get a call from Rabbi Marvin Heyer, the dean and founder of the Wiesenthal Center. They asked me to come in and meet with them. So I come in. I bring my mom with me for, you know, backup and protection, you know. I could be a thug for 15 years, but, you know, when it comes to talking to two rabbis, I'm bringing
her. Sit her in front, right?
Save me, Mom. So we ended up talking that day. About 3 weeks go by, and Robbie Cooper asked me to go to lunch, and he asked me if I'd speak out against my former friends. And I told him, you know, talking to you and the cops is one thing, but if I go public against these guys, they have a memory that doesn't easily erase, and I could be seriously in danger along with my family. So I need to talk it over with them. So I went back home, and we had a family get-together, and my dad told me I'd be stupid if I did it because of what could happen to me. My mom said I had to do it. My brother Phil, who was a police officer, said, you spilt the milk and cleaned it up. And he's basically said, dude, you created it. You know how it works. And he says, if I could find a guy like you in a Hispanic gang or black gang that could help me do my work, I would not pass it up. So I thought about it, and I told the Wiesenthal Center I would do it on one condition. I had to talk to kids.
I'm wondering if there was a moment when you thought to yourself, I made the right choice by leaving, by doing what I'm doing.
I was up in Bakersfield, California, and that was one of the very first places I ever did a talk. About 3 years later, I come back, and I'm doing this police group. There's this girl in the back. Says, do you remember me? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. Should I? She goes, well, 3 years ago, you came out here, and you did a juvenile group, at-risk teens. And she goes, well, I was there. I was flunking out of school, and after hearing you speak, I went back, graduated high school. I'm now in my second year of college. I'm like, well, great. I said, well, what did I do? She goes, well, I figured if your dumb butt could do it, anybody could do it.
That's sort of a backhanded compliment.
That was probably the greatest compliment I've ever gotten in my life.
T.J. Lydon's story is back in the news again this week with a new report that says the military's been accepting more and more felons to meet its recruiting quotas. T.J. says that skinhead and white supremacist groups are actually getting a lot better at exploiting the military training that's available.
The white supremacist movement has been pushing heavy. There's been articles in white supremacy magazines about how to get into the military and get into certain fields and start preparing, how to stay stealth inside the military until you want to get discharged and then openly show off your views. The problem is even sometimes when they show off their views, the military doesn't discharge them.
Well, there's another problem, and that is that we've all been reading, you know, since the war in Iraq began, that virtually every level of the military is having a more difficult time recruiting people. Does that make it easier for white supremacist kids to get in or to think, hey, I'm going to take my chance in the recruiting office?
When you have a recruiter that's told you will get X number of bodies in the military every month, and if you miss a month, you're going to make up for the next month. Because if you don't, we're going to send you back to the fleet with a black mark on your record. So what these guys are doing is these guys are seeing bodies come in. As long as they ain't got a big, huge swastika on their body, or they don't got the words white power written across their back, okay, you're not a white supremacist. Get him in the military. Gets in, goes to boot camp. Now he's in Iraq. He's learning combat skills. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, he is learning urban guerrilla warfare.
Do you know that to be the case, or is this sort of hearsay?
No, this is the case. There are guys in the military who, Southern Poverty Law Center, ADL, Simon Wiesenthal Center, I know, that have been white supremacists active on the list of active white supremacists who are now in the military serving. They're going to bring that back, and they're going to be training other people.
So what's the fix?
They need to take the recruiters, and the recruiters need to be trained on what gang tattoos look like. You're still going to get these guys coming into the military because some of them are going to walk into recruiting offices without any tattoos, but you're going to get less of them.
And if that kind of crackdown happens within the military, is that going to have a serious impact on the white supremacist movement?
It'll make it harder for them to learn military tactics, and it'll make us a lot safer. You start training these guys in explosives and demolitions and stuff, it can be very bad. I think the second generation of skinheads that were raised with dads who are hardcore white supremacists, who were in the military, who are now giving their children combat training and skills, those are the kids that are going to be our Islamic Jihad, our Al-Qaeda, our Hamas.
So you think it's getting worse rather than getting better at present?
It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse in this country before it gets better.
T.J. Lydon has written a book about his experiences. It's called Skinhead Confessions. We have a link to that on our website, and you can find us at thestory.org. Last week, I talked with Nancy Peacock during her early years as a writer. She also worked as a house cleaner. Nancy wrote a book about trying to balance those two distinctly different professions. It's called A Broom of One's Own.
I always wanted to be viewed wholly, you know, and to not have to hide one part of myself, be it writing or house cleaning. I felt like this was my life. What was I going to do? I mean, there was no point in hiding any part of it. So I didn't ever find a way to navigate it.
After I talked with Nancy, I asked if any of you have also found yourselves holding down two jobs that required distinctly different aspects of your personality. The best letter I got came from someone who has asked that we not use her real name. Here's why. My next guest, I'll call her Grace, works days as a substitute teacher in a Los Angeles elementary school and weekend nights as an exotic dancer in Vegas. When I talked with Grace about getting started in these two different professions, she told me that the first day teaching was way worse.
It was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. I basically spent the whole day going, okay, raise your hand. No, don't come up to me. Stay in your seats. Okay, wait, I can't hear you. Everyone's talking at once. And I practically ran screaming from the room. I don't think I taught again for about a year. Later,
because
I was just so, I was traumatized, and I didn't realize that it's not always like that. To this day, I can't really tell you that kindergarten is my favorite. I'd like to go kind of in the middle, you know, the second, third, fourth grade. That's my comfort zone.
By contrast, Grace says that her first try as an exotic dancer was actually a lot easier. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Grace says the dancing part of her life began years ago. She was a college student in Arizona. She needed money, saw an ad in the paper for dancers, and thought, what the heck? Although her new workplace was, at first glance, pretty unappealing.
Everyone was all kind of drugged out. It really wasn't the best place to start. and so that night I kind of chickened out, and I said, let me just cocktail waitress. And I think I went home with like $8. And so the next night I went in, I said, I'm going to try dancing. And I made, you know, I walked out of there with $100, which for me at 19, I guess, I mean, that was the most money I'd made, like, you know, in a few hours. I was like, oh my God, this is great, you know.
How easy was it, though, your very first time? Does somebody say, what music do you like, or what are you going to wear, or what are you going to do, or do they just say, the stage is yours, get up there? How does it work?
You know, house mom just kind of, you know, back then we had to wear, like, pantyhose rolled up under our thongs, our G-strings, so that was a lot of fun. But, you know, and she just kind of showed me, like, how to do the butt roll.
So you're wearing, like, stocking, are you? Is that what you mean by pantyhose rolled up?
Just regular, like, you know, nude pantyhose pulled up, but of course then, you know, you didn't want it to show around your stomach, so you had to then roll it up under your G-string, so it was like seamless. And
there's no waistband then, above the G-string.
Right, exactly, because, you know, it's just me. And then, you know, you had to safety pin it. I mean, it was a whole rigmarole. And then you had to wear these little things, I guess, to cover your, I don't know if I can say nipples.
You can say that word, yeah.
Okay, but, you know, you had to wear this kind of pasty stuff because it was, you know, the law. When it came to going on stage, that kind of really didn't bother me. I mean, I was just kind of dancing to music, but the up close and personal, the actual table dancing was the thing that I was a little bit nervous about at first, but I realized, well, maybe they'd throw you a dollar here or there on stage, but really, if you were going to make any kind of money and have it, you know, be worthwhile, you had to go up to the guys and say, hi, you know, would you like a dance? And you just had to go through that.
Did you tell people what you did at night?
I didn't, but people found out because I was working in a college town, and so I saw people. And then when I started attending that college, people recognized me. I remember, though, when I started dating my boyfriend at the time, I was, you know, honest with him, and I went to tell him within the first month that we were together, and he already knew. He already knew, but he was polite enough not to say anything to me. He was very respectful of my privacy.
In those early months of dancing, was there a time when you thought to yourself, I like this, or was it always just about the money?
I don't think that I ever felt like I have to do this because I got to pay the bills. There was no pressure. And so it was fun meeting these girls with these different, you know, personalities. I remember the one of my bosses used to always just kind of look at me and go like, Grace, your hair, do something with your hair, put on some more makeup. Like, I mean, because also at 19, I've always looked very young. I'm sure that I looked like 15 or 16.
And so for the past 7 years, Grace has been dancing and teaching and working to keep those two parts of her life separate. I'll ask her how she manages that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Lots of people hold down two jobs. Lots of people have to do that to make ends meet. When I asked you a few days ago if you ever held two jobs that seemed oddly contradictory, I got a letter from a woman who's both an elementary school teacher and an exotic dancer.
People who see me when I'm teaching, I mean, they would never in a million years guess what I do on the side. I mean, my first boyfriend that I ever had, when I told him that I danced, because I was dancing back then too, he kind of laughed at me like, you know, like he thought it was a joke. And I said, no, I'm serious. This is what I do.
My guest asked that we not use her name. She says she'd almost certainly get fired from her substitute teaching job in L.A. if parents or principals knew that on weekends she drives to Vegas and takes her clothes off on stage. So I'm calling her Grace. And there's one part of Grace's story that doesn't make sense to me. If she can make good money as an exotic dancer, why teach?
Dancing in L.A., you know, you would think, oh, it's Los Angeles, you must make a lot of money. Not true. For some reason, the place that I worked at, though it was a great place and it was fun and it was, you know, a lot of celebrities would show up, there wasn't a lot of money to be had. And by the end of the night, when you felt like you had worked so hard and, you know, I was barely scraping together $100, a lot of the girls, me included, you know, if you had a bad night, you'd be crying, literally crying by the end of the night. It's just a lot of pressure. And I thought, you know, I need to go back to substitute teaching because at least when I walk into that classroom, I know that I'm going to put in my six-hour day and I'm going to leave with over $100 and I don't have to go through this pain and suffering. When I finally went back a year later and I started doing it more regularly, I realized, hey, you know, I'm pretty good at this. And people would comment too because I would start getting a lot of, oh, you know, are you going for a full-time teaching? And I'd say, no, I'm actually out here pursuing acting. So I started to get a lot of positive feedback.
And did you develop, like, relationships with the kids that you were teaching, with their parents? Were you involved at that point? Or as a substitute teacher, were you always kind of a visitor there, Grace?
You are pretty much, you know, you're a visitor, you're the outsider. But there are a lot of schools that I go to pretty regularly, so I know the teachers and I know the kids, and they'll come up to me, you know, hi. And I don't really get to develop long-term relationships with the kids, although I've done several long-term assignments where I have been in a classroom a month or two or three, and that's when I feel like the magic really happens, that you do develop those relationships. My long-term assignments have been in special ed. I really enjoy working with those kids. Those relationships have been really rewarding. And of course, it's always sad when you leave. But even as a full-time teacher, I mean, eventually you got to say goodbye to the kids. So
I'm from a family of teachers, not exotic dancers. And and all the teachers in my family just, you know, like, it's a really hard job. It grinds them down. Which is harder?
Wow, that's a good question. Well, definitely there are days when I leave the classroom and I think to myself, I am not getting paid enough to do this and I am completely exhausted. And there's many a day when I go home and I take a nap. When I'm dancing and I finish an 8 9-10 hour shift, you know, I'm exhausted too, but I've got a few $100s, like more than I would make teaching. Mm-hmm. The teaching is more, it's definitely more rewarding, but you know, the dancing is and has always been, it's a means to an end, that it's something that I need to be doing at the moment. I know a lot of the patrons would not like to hear this, but I would say that, you know, for 99% of the girls, that's what it is. Yeah. It's the money. I don't care what the girls say to the contrary, but I feel like every girl who, or 99% of the women who dance, they do it because, whether it's true or not, they do it because they feel they need to do it. Whether it's to support a drug habit, or whether it's to support them going through college or law school, or they're a single mom raising their kid, or maybe it's just that they're not educated, they don't know what to do in life, and they're not ready to take on that responsibility yet.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Grace has been studying acting, but to make ends meet, she works as a teacher and an exotic dancer, and she's learned that she has to keep these two jobs well separated. Grace says that when she was younger, there was a time when she didn't do that. See, she says at most clubs, there's lots of drinking and there are drugs around, and there were days when she'd show up in the classroom and she really shouldn't have been there.
I was working at this one school, and I don't even know how I dragged myself in that morning, probably just out of a sense of duty and responsibility and maybe to get back at myself for the night before. But I was in the classroom, and thankfully, I think there was either an assistant in the room or maybe I knocked on the next door, you know, teacher's door, and I said, you know, I'm not feeling well. Do you mind covering for a few minutes? As I went to the bathroom and basically, you know, puked my guts up. And thankfully, I guess I had brought some water and, you know, crackers, and I just kind of, I toughed it out, you know, and I told myself, I said, you got to do this. You got to handle it. You got to get through the day and make this be a reminder to not get yourself into the situation again.
There must have been people at that school or at other places who look at you and go, wait a minute here.
Right. I tried to cover it as best I could, and just told them that I, you know, was sick or wasn't feeling well. But I mean, I don't know whether it was the guilt or paranoia, but I'm sure, I mean, I remember the look on the one guy's face when I came back into the room, and you know, just almost like a silent kind of, you know.
This is your teaching assistant for the day, right?
yeah, exactly. And you know, and there was another time where I was on a long-term assignment. It was a special ed pre-kindergarten class, and you know, I knew that one of my assistants, she had told me that her son had a very bad drug problem. So I came in one morning on no sleep, still feeling the effects of the cocaine from the night before. I was just kind of out of my mind. I basically plopped myself down on the beanbag chair in the room and was just trying to tough it out. And I could barely look at this woman because I thought, she's been through this with her son. She's got to know.
She knows, yeah.
But she didn't say anything to me, thankfully. But you feel so incredibly, horribly guilty. I mean, just like, what am I doing? This is so wrong. And that's actually what led me to quit that one job, because I knew that I had to get away from that environment, which I did.
How important has it been over the past 6 years to keep these two lives completely separate? I mean, you tell the other dancers that you're a teacher. Do you tell the other teachers that you're a dancer?
As for teaching, nobody, I would never tell anyone. I mean, aside from the fact that I could get fired, I mean, I just don't think that anyone in the teaching profession would understand. I mean, men would probably get a chuckle out of it. The women would probably not appreciate it. And even in my personal life, I mean, you know, I've been living in L.A. for 10 years, and in the beginning, when I first started dancing in L.A., I did tell a few people who I thought were close to me, and they ended up not respecting my privacy.
What is this about not respecting your privacy? What happened?
You know, I've been out here pursuing acting, and I've always been taking acting classes, and, you know, you get to know the people in your acting classes, and I just remember this couple, these friends of mine, they started getting suspicious why I couldn't, I kept missing all these rehearsals. And I'm not a good liar. I've never been a good liar. I'd rather just not say anything at all. So I kind of tried to fudge my way through, and I basically told them, well, you know, I have to work tonight. I'm, you know, dancing. And, you know, I told them that in confidence, but I found out later that they ended up telling, you know, they told two friends and they told two friends. And when I went to get another part-time job somewhere else, it's like everyone at that job knew. And it's just, you know, I really do have a big sense of privacy. I don't like that. I don't like people to know that about me unless I tell them. Now, I really don't tell anyone, even people who are close to me, who have nothing to do with the teaching profession. There's only a handful of people who know me who actually know where I go every other weekend.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest has two professions, teacher and exotic dancer. And while Grace has made it her policy to keep those two worlds far apart, she says she always has to be careful.
I do remember this one time, though. It was after I had been doing a long-term teaching assignment for this special ed pre-kindergarten class, and I was at a 99-cent store, and I walked in, and I froze. Literally, I just stopped in my tracks because I recognized one of the guys who was working there, and I thought, oh, my God, do I know him from the club?
What do you mean, do I know him from the club, or do I know him as the parent of a kid in one of my classes?
Well, exactly. Thankfully, that's what it was. He was the parent of one of the kids. You know, I had gotten to see him on a regular basis because it was a long-term assignment. But that happened a few times where I saw someone that I recognized, and in that few seconds, I didn't remember where I recognized them from. And so my first thought was, oh, my God, they've seen me, you know, stripping at the club.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. Here. Table dance or parent-teacher conference? Which one was it?
Seriously. And at that time, once I recognized that that's where I knew him from, that he was a parent of one of the children, I just relaxed. But it's very freaky. It's very scary.
And if you have to try and keep these two lives separate, do you always carry around with you this little bit of fear that you're going to lose it, that some guy's going to walk up to you and say, hey, my daughter's in your class, and I saw you in Vegas on Friday night?
Right.
Grace says that as weird as it seems trying to keep the jobs and the friends and the relationships apart, she thinks that her two lives as an exotic dancer and teacher give her something that a lot of other people don't get.
I've always strived for normalcy in my life, yet I've never felt quite like a, you know, quote-unquote normal person, which is fine. I mean, normal is boring. But, you know, half of me, I mean, I'd love to be married, you know, by this point in my life. I want the house with the picket fence, you know. I'd like a family. And I'm very traditional, believe it or not. I'm very traditional in my views. So, you know, the teaching brings that normalcy to me, which I really need. I'd go crazy without. On the other hand, the dancing, it's like, I know this is going to sound really strange, but I'm not ashamed that I dance and that I have danced. I mean, I would have never imagined that I would still be doing it at this point in my life. But what I've gotten from the dancing is just seeing this whole other side of life, a side of life that, you know, tells me, like, who am I to judge anyone else for what they do? And the crazy part that I was going to say is, like, I kind of liken it to people who've gone to war together. They're brothers, you know, or people who've gone through a tragedy together. They bond, you know, they're your brothers, they're your sisters. Well, in the dancing world, there is actually that kind of bond. I mean, I've seen a lot of catfighting too, but there's this bond that I can't explain, that it's like we're all sisters, we're all in this together. And I don't know, I appreciate that. I appreciate being able to see the world through that open mind.
And I'm trying to think about it in personal terms, though. I mean, is there a good Grace who dresses as a substitute teacher and goes into a second grade classroom and pats the kids on the head, and then a bad Grace, you know, who pulls on her stockings and her G-string and dances at midnight in a club in Vegas?
Yeah, there are a lot of times where dealing with, you know, everyday life things where I'm heading to Vegas for the weekend and I'm thinking, I can't wait to get out of this town and get away from the BS and just be completely irresponsible and, you know, and just dance and have a few drinks and have a good time. Absolutely. Because in my normal life, I mean, I'm pretty boring. You know, I rarely go out. The most drinking I do in a month, I usually do at the club when I'm dancing. Yeah, it's definitely a good outlet.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Grace says that she's had some time to think about the way that her two different jobs complement each other.
I think I'm just a bit more, you know, open-minded and savvy. And, I, you know, maybe I would be comfortable talking to the children about things that maybe another teacher might not. I mean, certainly not about my other job, but there's not a lot that shocks me. You know, there's not a lot that surprises me, and I'm very kind of down to earth, and I can kind of, you know, talk to the kids like streetwise, if you will, level. You know, you definitely, you hear stories about some of the homes that the kids, you know, come from and, you know, who's in jail and who's in a gang or whatever.
Do you mind me asking how old you are now, Grace?
I am 37 right now, and I never in a million years would have guessed that I would have still been dancing at this point. I mean, I haven't done it consecutively from the age of 19 to 37.
Right.
Oh my God, that sounds like such a long time. I've, you know, there have been years where I've taken off, but you know, I don't have that many years, you know, left. And again, I mean, why would I want to? You know, I always thought that I'd be done with it by the age of 30. But there's always a reason.
10 years ago, you went to L.A. with the idea that you might make it as an actor. And I'm wondering, how's that going?
I have to say I'm a little disappointed because you come out here knowing it's not going to be easy. I mean, the pursuit of an acting career is probably one of the most difficult things you can do. But I feel like I've spent more time out here just, you know, trying to, you know, survive and pay the bills. I've, you know, done little things, little student films and some small independent things, but never really gotten a lot of auditions, was never able to get a theatrical agent. And so I just haven't been able to go out and audition for the pilots or the, you know, the big things. Mm-hmm. And which is kind of disappointing. I love acting. I mean, I'm still taking classes and it's very hard to break away from. But at age 37, I feel like I need to get on with my life. And
as I'm listening to you talk, though, I'm thinking to myself that your dual lives, your, you know, I'm a teacher today, I'm a stripper tomorrow. I mean, you lead a permanent acting life, right? Because you're either in one role or the other.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, I definitely have a great story in my head about the duality of the dancing and the teaching. Absolutely. I just can't figure out whether I want to make it, you know, more of like a very sad drama.
I was going to say, is it a tragedy? Is it a comedy?
It's really a little bit of both. You know, I mean,
you got to sort that out, Grace.
I know.
Grace joined me from a studio in L.A. Maybe her story has you thinking about the separate kind of life or lives that you might be living. And the chance to talk about that. If that's the case, you can send me a note. Just go to our website at thestory.org or leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I did that too quickly. I'll tell you again, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.